in Downey, California, the 15th of April 1994, an interview with Dr. Jacqueline Perry in her office at Rancho Los Amigos Hospital. Jackie, first of all, it's great to see you again after these years. I just want to go over, just ask you a few questions and really go back to the beginning of your extraordinary professional career. Were you born in California?
No, I was actually born in Denver, Colorado, but I moved here when I was about age 7.
Uh-huh. You moved to Los Angeles.
Moved to Los Angeles, right.
So most of your schooling was in Los Angeles, huh?
Yes, all through college. Then I went and then I went to Washington, D.C. for physical therapy. Then I was in the Army.
Now tell me, what year did you finish physiotherapy?
1940. 41, actually. I finished college in 1940.
I see. And you served in the Army after finishing with your physiotherapy degree.
That's right, for 5.5 years.
Did you serve overseas?
Well, mostly I taught in the United States, but I spent about 6 months down in Puerto Rico.
Was this in the field of rehabilitation or general in a military hospital? Or?
Yes, it was the Army hospital. They were usually general hospitals, and so it was basically medical physical therapy. With lots of, you know, fractures and backaches and various things.
So what influenced you to go into medical school?
I wanted to make my own decisions.
Uh-huh. And
and I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon.
And what stimulated you to be, I mean, was there any person or teacher that you came across who interested you in orthopedics or?
No, I worked with lots of orthopedists. I knew that's the kind of thing I wanted to do, so I found a way to get medical. And GI Bill got me into medical school.
GI Bill, huh?
That's right.
Now, tell me, which medical school was it, Jackie?
University of California in San Francisco.
And what year did you graduate from there?
Graduated from there in 1950.
And your residency was in San Francisco?
Yes, it was the University of California, San Francisco.
And which... which hospital in San Francisco?
Well, I was at the university, and I was at Children's Hospital, and I was at Franklin Hospital. Franklin Hospital is a private hospital.
Uh-huh.
Well, technically, Children's was too, but it was a woman's and Children's Hospital at that time.
Mm. Is Franklin still in existence?
It's called the R.K. Davis now.
R.K. Davis.
That's right.
Were there any particular teachers in your undergraduate or early residency days that were to be an influence in your career?
Oh, yeah, we had some great orthopedists. We had Roy Abbott, who loved anatomy.
Roy Abbott, yes.
And we had Fred Bost, who was a superb person, and Floyd Jurgensen and Lucas would be the four people I would think of.
Mm-hmm. And where did you do your orthopedic... you did your orthopedic residency, I'm sorry, in San Francisco.
Yes.
Now, from an early stage, you joined the staff at Rancho Downey, did you?
Yes, I came here in 1955, right at the end of my residency.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you choose Rancho Los Amigos Hospital?
Well, I really liked reconstructive work better than trauma. And I really was not a business person. I didn't want to worry about running an office. And Rancho was the only place in the world I know of that provided reconstructive surgery and a paycheck.
Ah. Now, you formed a very early alliance or friendship with Vernon Nichol, didn't you?
Yes. Vernon Nichol was a brother of Eldon Nichol, who was one of my classmates. And Vernon was looking for help down here. And this actually ranch was built for me, exactly the kind of thing I wanted to do. So it was very easy to say yes.
Uh-huh. And what post did you take on in 55?
Well, they had to make a post because the county paid so little that I came in as a head orthopedic surgeon, which is under... Well, I was only the second one, so...
And Nick was the first one?
Sure, Nick was the first one.
Uh-huh. And I think in those days, Rancho coped with a huge polio problem, didn't it?
Yeah, polio was a total active program at that time. And the major difference we made, Vernon started and I sort of expanded, was surgery on the respiratory-dependent patient. And he figured out that if you could do emergency surgery on him for pregnancy and kidney stones, you could do elective surgery. Mm. And so we started a program, and I've done about 300 spine fusions on that population.
How did you cope looking back? It would probably be illegal now without an intensive care unit, would it?
Well, you naturally had an intensive care program because you had all these respiratory facilities and respiratory physicians, and we had a small post-op program, and then they came back down to the regular wards, and they had all the good. Actually, at that time, we had lots of nursing. We had 10 hours of nursing per patient. Now we're down to about 6 or 4. Mm. We really were very rich at that time, nursing.
But I seem to remember you talking a lot about tracheostomies. I think that was an important part of the program, wasn't it, treating the respiratory cripples?
Yes, we really had had three levels as far as surgical planning. If they were above 60%, they were independent breathers, and that was not a problem. Between 60 and 30% of vital capacity, it depended on what procedure. And, of course, you're going to do spine work. That was very challenging. And so we'd do elective tracheostomies, and
you were saying elective tracheostomy.
Yes, we had John Affelt and his... John Affelt, who was medical director of Rancho, and he was actually headed, and he established the respiratory care program here in polio. And he came in 1951. Vernon Nickel came in 53, and I came in 55. Interesting enough, we're all exactly the same age until the same month of birth.
Go on.
So we sort of related very well.
Uh-huh.
Anyhow, what he and his respiratory engineers had developed was a gold foil system, which you could measure the carbon dioxide levels within the respiratory air, the pulmonary air, and so you could get immediate equivalent to blood CO2s by just a tube in the nose, and so you could control your breathing very easily.
Mm.
And so, and of course, with spine work, you couldn't really have a respirator. You couldn't get to them, and you couldn't, and you couldn't use chest respirators because they're not that efficient. And so we'd use tanks, we'd use tracheostomies and positive pressure breathing and to manage them directly. And the real challenge, and that, of course, they were using anyhow for a lot of their patients, so it was
yes.
not, we just applied to the surgery patient. And then the real challenge was when you put them to sleep and woke them up, and because anesthesiologists are accustomed to sort of getting things set up and then letting the patient sort of take care of themselves as they wake up until they... But of course, our patients couldn't do that because they would have a lower response to the same stimulus, and so you'd have to hover over them and help them wake up. That was the biggest challenge, really. And then the other real challenge was not ventilating them and knocking the CO2 down too low in anxiety, making sure you adequately ventilate them. And this is where the CO2 analyzer came in so valuable.
Were there any... this is all before the vaccines, isn't it? Before the Salk and Sabin vaccines?
Actually, it was started before it, but the vaccine came in 1955. But we had at least 3 years of intense surgery before we got caught up on the backlog. And then actually polio surgery dropped down very quickly in about 61 or 62. And then we changed, but we changed other things right away because as soon as the vaccine came in, we stopped having acute polio. And we had... Vernon Nickel had been down around the county medical center and identified all these other patients. And the biggest problem we had at that time was spinal cord injury. Had no rehab, and they were just drifting from one service to another and had no way of getting out of the hospital because they couldn't get their function going and their urinary tract was a problem. So we started that group about the late 55, early 56. And we started expanding into other disabilities. Then we had stroke, and then we had arthritis. There's the three major areas.
And back pain was always a big field here, wasn't it?
No.
Was it not?
No.
I thought Verd Mooney had a particular interest in it.
Well, he did late. He started a program of pain rehab, and so I should have said yes. But that was much later in our program. And then it became a question that, no one fund inpatient care, so that sort of died a natural death.
What was the... Verd Nickel was an extraordinary man, wasn't he?
Oh, he was very... He was probably another Robert Jones.
Was he really?
He was very personable, very gregarious, exciting. His real skill was seeing the unusual and stimulating people to do something new. and loved doing it.
Yeah.
And so he really grew on the strength of stimulating other people.
Yeah. He's certainly the most electrifying man I ever met. I mean, he was a very exciting person. He was the young man's sort of stimulus, wasn't he?
That's
he always
right.
was looking around for young people to...
Oh, yes.
to and he appreciated a challenge.
He looked for challenges, and he looked at, for the unusual, and that's why we started the spinal cord injury program when no one was doing anything with civilians. They had some, you know, Veterans Administration centers, but nothing like what we developed.
No.
And then he also looked at how you could help people with surgery and didn't consider that that was contraindicated by chronic disease.
And yeah. He was Canadian by birth, wasn't he?
Yes, he came from Saskatchewan.
Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. Why? How did he finish down here? Was it...
Well, they came from a rural area, and he and his brother wanted to be doctors. In fact, Vernon's story is he wanted to be a doctor because the person in town that had the most beautiful horses was a doctor. And that was his stimulus source. But he went well beyond that.
Yeah.
So he and his brother hitched their way down here and managed to support themselves, and actually they took turns, and I don't know how they got medical school, but they did. Well, they went to one of the, you know, finished college in one of the local Seventh-day Adventist colleges first.
Mm.
And then they got in medical school, and they took turns supporting each other. And actually, Eldon got caught by the draft, so he was in the service 5 years, and Vernon finished medical school, and he went in the service after the war. And,
mm-hmm.
and then Eldon and I, our classmates, we were both post-World War II students.
I see. And would you say, I mean, you and Verna Nickel really set this place going.
Yes.
There wasn't much going before you.
No. They had an orthopedist come in, but they did about 22 cases a year.
Mm.
You had a population of 300 inpatients, with, say 85% of them needing it or something like that. And then Vernon doubled that, and then the year I came, we doubled that. Because I was here. I was the one really full-time person for a few years. And then when Alice Garrett joined us, and then we went off from there, and Vernon attracted more and more people to the other specialties. And we had other, you know, like Shannon Stauffer came in and took over the spinal injury service, and attracted Bert Mooney, who first helped me with the stroke and then took over the stroke service. Then he got into back pain, and then he got into amputations. And then we attracted other people.
You were saying earlier that the late Professor Hodson visited you here in the early 60s.
Yes, I think it was about 1961. He came by, and I was very impressed with his creativity and his idea of going to anteriorly and finding out where the disease was instead of running behind.
His idea of going into the front of the spine.
That's right. Mm. And because and so that and I was very impressed with his honesty and his intelligence and his practical planning. So when a couple of years later, when I had a patient come here that had just the problem, it had a TP spine, it had a laminectomy.
This was operated here.
And I operated on it.
Uh-huh.
And I told you a little earlier that...
But the laminectomy had been done.
The laminectomy had already been done.
Mm.
And she had, you know, temporary relief, and then got worse because she now had an unstable spine, as you well know, both front and back.
Mm.
And so I told her that we needed to do a Hodgson's procedure. She asked if I'd ever done one. I said, no. But she figured I had an adequate reputation. So I got a general surgeon to get me in, and we did it. She did well.
That's very, very good, isn't it?
And so we did a few more. And then that, of course, led to the osteotomy I did later.
Yeah, sure. Now, when I went to Hong Kong early in 1968, I think you joined me later that year. I think Hoddy had invited you out. Would you say a few words about going out to Hong Kong?
Yeah, he brought me out to sort of organize their polio program, because and they just were starting a hospital. In fact, they started the year before I came, and I didn't come that year because I had a disc of my own.
This was the Sandy Bay.
In Sandy Bay,
yeah,
they just started the surgical suites, and they had one Dr. Chan who was doing a little surgery.
K.P. Chan,
and so I came out and sort of guided the surgery and guided the clinical evaluations and brought in some concepts of bracing, and then we had surgery time and needed a new surgeon, so we got you involved.
That's right, exactly. I remember it like it was yesterday. Was the polio there similar to what you'd been dealing with here at Rancho? Probably a younger age group.
Well, we had both adults and children here.
Mm-hmm.
And the polio, they'd had the vaccine promptly. So in Hong Kong, so they were all sort of post-polio about 10 years when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have adequate bracing, and the surgery was just beginning.
Mm-hmm. And you enjoyed your time in Hong Kong?
Very much. It was a great place.
Yeah, there were extraordinary days. It's changed a lot now.
What I remember, one of the things I remember is having cocktails on your porch overlooking the sunset. You had the better apartment.
That's right. I had the one looking over the China Sea. But yes, they were extraordinary days, weren't they? And
yeah.
I don't think it'll ever be the same again there now.
That's unfortunate.
But the diseases have changed. I mean, polio and TB are practically non-existent
there
now. I mean, I don't think there's any sort of fresh outbreak at all.
That's good.
But, of course, there were extraordinary days with spinal surgery, with the TB, the polio, the back pain. I mean, everything was banging along. It was extraordinary, wasn't it?
That's right. It was a very, very dynamic time.
Yeah. Do you remember Alan Dwyer?
Oh, yes. I remember him very well. I saw him do his first case in Hong Kong.
That's right.
Cables.
September 68. And the nuns, of course, you remember well.
Oh, yes, I surely do.
Yeah, yeah.
Sister Margaret and Justine and Barbara.
Yeah, Sister Margaret took the x-rays.
That's right,
yeah.
She surely did.
Yeah. Well, there's a new medical school there now. Did you know the Chinese University? There's a new university and a new medical school associated with that on the mainland side.
No, I don't know anything about that.
Did you see any of the leprosy work there?
No, I didn't.
That was on Hailing Chow.
That's right.
Did you not see
it? I knew they had it, but somehow I never got there.
Yeah. Well, that's all dried up now, too.
Really?
Yes.
We have a young woman here, an orthopedic surgeon, who's very interested in that, and she's involved in our program in Southern California. She spent a lot of time with Paul Brand.
Oh, Paul Brand, yes. Uh-huh. Yes. And when you came back here, I don't think you operated much after you left Hong Kong, did you?
Well, no, I managed to kink a vertebral artery. Turned out that I had a congenitally small vertebral artery, and I had limited back motion from my disc, and so I used my neck, chin on my chest, and I kinked this artery and gave myself a brainstem lesion, so I can't shake my head.
Dear.
And suddenly, I could do a carpal tunnel, and I could do a trigger finger, but it wasn't much of a surgical plan. So I went into non-operative care, and that's when I started getting into gait analysis.
Uh-huh.
Started the laboratory here.
Uh-huh. And do you find much interest in gait amongst orthopedic surgeons in general?
Not in general, no. They like to know about it for specific situations.
Mm.
But if it relates to how their surgery and their diagnosis, why it has to be, but it has to be very, very focused for them.
Mm.
They're not abstract.
They're not interested in the sort of in the problem of gait. Analysis per se.
Not really.
No. What about physiotherapists? Are they interested?
They're very strongly interested in it. And they're the strongest group. And we, on the other hand, we've taught gait to the residents all along, and we have a very well-organized course. And the residents think it's an asset to have learned that.
Mm.
And they're a little reluctant to show up, but they're glad they've learned it after they've shown up.
I would have thought, looking back and learning gait from you, treating with polio patients in Hong Kong with you, that I gait really should be taught with anatomy, shouldn't it? Or is it too applied for that?
No, it'd be a logical thing to do.
Mm.
And because when you're studying the extremity, the only really trouble with doing that is the time of anatomy is so concentrated and so dense because you're learning vascular anatomy, and you're learning bones and muscles, and it's really be good actually in when you look concentrating just on extremity anatomy and things like that. That's very valuable.
I mean, learning about the muscle and the joint and then learning about the function.
Oh, that's the thing to do, really.
Yeah, the structure and the function. Do you think there's much place for gait analysis in back pain in general, the problem of back pain?
Well, we've done a little bit with a ball. There are two answers to that. One is the pattern of force impacts of walking, because each step is a jarring experience.
Hmm.
And but the other is we've been doing some.
How do you mean it's a jarring experience?
Well, you actually fall on your forward leg. And the old idea of falling forward and catching yourself really is true. That's what gait is. We use a lot of maneuvers to soften that.
Falling forward and catching yourself.
Yes, if you take a step, you put one leg out, and you roll yourself over, but there's at least a centimeter, you just plain have a free fall, and then you have to you reduce that impact by bending letting your knee bend and catching yourself for your quadriceps. But if you have any weakness of your quadriceps, like from disability of inactivity, by then you're going to load with that locked knee, and then you're going to increase the impact.
Oh, right.
The other thing we've found, I've been doing some work with Obachi, Boachi, and we've just been doing some little...
This is Dr. Boachi from the East Coast.
Well, he's going back to the East Coast.
Oh, is he? Yes.
Yes, he's going back to hospital special surgery. He's been out here for a few years, two or three.
He's working here at Rancho, is he?
Yes, and then he practices in Whittier. And we've been following some of his patients from his practice, and what I'm finding is a gait that's consistent with a weak calf, which suggests that the S1 root is a little bit vulnerable to some of this extensive surgery. And these people are demonstrating some knee instability and the heel stayed on the ground instead of rolling off like it should. And
which patients are these, Jackie?
These are patients who've most of it are redos from previous surgery, and he ends up with massive instrumentation to stabilize a lumbar sacral spine and farther up. And if they and actually by stabilizing their painful back, their gait does improve. Their walking velocity and stride length improves, but they show a little bit the lack of pelvic rotation, and then they show this weak calf.
This is before he's operated.
Well, they show it before and after, because of course you fused them afterwards. We fused them with the surgery, so they don't have pelvic rotation then, and they have a little bit limitation of stride length. But they also seem the majority of them have this weak calf. Now whether it's due to S1 root lesion or whether it's due to poor rehabilitation or lack of, you're just glad they walk.
I mean, is this weak to MRC testing? Are you talking about a power 4 calf muscle?
Well, they walk like a power 3 or less.
Do they really?
Yeah, they do not. Their heel does not roll off until their foot's on the other ground. Basically, in walking, you have the progression of your weight-bearing limb after you've loaded it is first you roll at the ankle, then you roll onto your forefoot and the heel comes up. And about half of that single stance time should be a heel off period.
Yeah.
And if your calf is weak, mainly the soleus, which is a deeper but very larger muscle, why the heel stayed on the ground and you have such essentially a flat foot gait and a shorter step. And that's what these people show.
And what do you think is the mechanism of this weak calf? You think it's probably an S1?
Well, it seemed like an S1, because we weren't testing him a year after surgery, or maybe 5 years after surgery. Maybe they're now in disuse, because it's a muscle that has a lot of strain. It works, the calf muscles work over half the weight-bearing period of time. In fact, they work 40% of the whole gait cycle, so they're working 80% of the stance time. In contrast, the quadriceps works 15%. So the quadriceps had a quick load to allow you to bend your knee and for shock absorption, but the calf stabilizes you while you roll across your foot.
Uh-huh.
And we've not written that up. We're sort of looking at it now.
Right. What do you think, from your experience, are the best parameters in terms of gait in assessing, say, spinal? Patients with spinal disorders. I mean, you mentioned stride length and you mentioned speed.
Those are it. Those are the best things. Now, stride length is probably more related, and certainly is with hip surgery, than speed, because if a person doesn't have an adequate stride length, they make it up with a quicker step or a quicker cadence. So velocity is a little bit... Velocity summarizes what they can do. But as far as actually identifying what the back contributes by, I think it would be stride length.
Do you think that all patients with back pain, chronic back pain problems, should have speed and stride length assessed?
I would think it'd be logical as an outcome measure.
Yeah, as an assessment before and then after the outcome of whatever you do. And, I mean, looking back over your time, do you think back pain has been a badly treated or ignored subject, or what?
Well, I haven't had a lot of... I've been a personal patient involved. I haven't had a lot of clinical experience with that group because I did massive scoliosis. My way into the pain population, but
Do you think that's a challenging group, the pain one?
Oh yeah, I think it is, and I think it I think, as I've just mentioned earlier, I run this gait clinic, which is mainly a post-polio clinic, but I see other kinds of problems when physicians I know send me a special case. And I've seen a couple of these recently. In fact, I've seen three recently, and manner of the back and the loss of lordosis is a major complication.
Now, you mean the flattening of the back with over-enthusiastic back surgery?
Oh, yes, because, most people have about a 10-degree flexion contraction in their hips.
Have they?
Yes.
Normal. Yeah.
Yeah, so if you flatten the back, if you take the average person and really bend their hip up so the back is flat, they'll have a 15-degree flexion contraction.
Go on.
And then
that's an important. I mean, that's a structural normality. It's not a thing one should get rid of.
Well, the athlete probably doesn't have any. But you only can stretch the hip no more than 10 degrees back. It doesn't have much hyperextension range.
And no.
So you're counting on lordosis to stand upright.
Yeah.
And if you flatten that back and their femur is straight up, their pelvis is going to tilt forward, and they're leaning forward.
Yeah.
Then this creates two problems. First of all, it creates stress on your back. And as well, not you'll get a tension strain on your fusion, which bones don't like, and contribute to back pain. And it increases demand on your hip extensors.
Yeah.
And those are often weak too in these patients. And again, whether it's this one root problems or whether it's disuse, I don't know. I haven't treated that group.
I must go back and look at my patients. I more than
excuse me.
Yes, Jackie, just getting back onto the gait analysis in spinal problems. I suppose the analysis is probably more relevant in the deformed spine or with spines with neurological problems in the lower limbs. But you see, you think that in back pain in general, there's some point with it. Perhaps, I mean, would you video patients with spinal pain? Do you think that's relevant or unnecessary?
Well, I'm not sure you'd see much by video. Well, if they lean forward, I guess it'd be a question whether they have an erect posture or forward posture or list one direction or another. And you probably know more about that looking at the spines than I do because I really haven't done it. I looked at the scoliotics, which obviously had curves.
Mm.
This reminds me, this conversation, we've done a project on the functional capacity of stroke patients. And I've been working with a gal actually from Ireland who's very interested in the WHO, World Health Organization, classification of impairment, disability, and handicap. And what point that she brought out is, and which fortunately our study looked at those three things without, and the point it brings out is that the surgeons or physicians in general look at how well they've cured them and the quality of the fusion and the quality of alignment. And the patient looks at whether they can walk again.
Mm.
And so I was thinking that we focused on just a simple recording of the gait with foot switches or something like that. One could identify the handicap residual or not and whether that's been resolved because pain, of course, prevents people from effectively walking. They struggle hither and yon.
Mm.
And so that would bring that capacity.
Sure.
And that could be your outcome measure.
Yes, yeah. You mentioned earlier the polio epidemics. You must be the world authority on the chronic polio problem, are you?
Well, I certainly have had the largest experience of any of the known clinics that I'm aware of, because Rancho, first of all, Southern California's always been endemic for polio, so they've always had a lot of people.
And do you still have acute polio here?
No.
No.
And we haven't had any for years. Nationwide, there used to be about 10 a year as a result of vaccine complications, but we had none last year.
Is it a vaccination compulsory by law?
Yes.
It is.
Uh-huh. It's part of the
federal law.
Well, I'm not sure if it's federal or state, but it's certainly true here, and we've had it for decades.
Yes.
It's part of the pediatric preparation to get into school.
Oh, I see. How many patients? I mean, you must have looked after hundreds through the 50s, did you? What sort of number did you have attending the clinic?
Well, they said we had about 5,000 respiratory patients go through during the peak time.
5,000 respiratory patients.
That's right. And then now I'm seeing But I must see at least 1,000 post-polios because I'm seeing 2 to 4 people per clinic twice a week. And I've been seeing this since about 1980.
Mm.
So a lot have gone through.
What happens to them in general? Do they start getting arthritis in their joints or muscle wasting or what?
Well, the answer is yes. So either to most commonly, basically it's an overuse problem because the acute polio left the neuromuscular system less able than we thought. And what it really did is kill some nerve cells. In fact, Bodian, who's a neuroscientist that studied this, identified a 95% invasion of the anterior horn cells with about a 50% recovery. This in monkeys.
Yeah.
And that goes anywhere from 12%, which would leave our severe paralyzed, that we'd all recognize, to 91%, which we'd not consider having any residual.
91%?
Some people have some monkeys had 91% recovery of their anterior horns cells, but the average is around 40%, 45%. And then...
You can have a cell actually damaged and surviving after polio, an anterior horn cell?
Yes, it could be injured but not killed. And those methods are going to be covering functions of the post-polio.
Yeah.
One was anterior horn cell healing, and the other is axon sprouting. And this was learned in peripheral nerve surgery actually during World War II, because in the research and in the clinical studies of axonal nerve, surgical exposure, they would have function recover better than they should have from what nerve damage they knew. And they finally identified it as the residual nerve cells would send out branches, axons would send out branches and pick up muscle fibers that didn't have innervation. So now, and that meant larger motor units. So if you take that and put it to the post-polio patient, what you had patient with less than the normal number of motor units, but the motor units were larger. And so you sort of had a smaller but less efficient system.
Now, smaller but more efficient, you mean?
They're more efficient in the sense that they activated more motor units, more muscle fibers, but less efficient because you had less precision. You'd have to activate the whole cluster.
And so,
on the other hand, the polio patient had normal sensation and normal control, so they could make this system go, and they did, and everyone encouraged them to do it.
Mm.
And basically, they were taught and learned how to overdo, to push the system, and sort of like squealing the tires on your car. We documented the overuse first because we used my gait lab to study the muscle function occurring in these patients. Patients would just show up complaining about new weakness and fatigue and pain, and they'd been stable for years, 20, 30, 30 plus years.
After the polio
attack.
After
polio, they were so-called cured.
And what was that due to?
Overuse.
Overuse.
When I recorded them, the EMG of their, during walking, you'd find that the muscle intensity was twice normal. And that would mean it was weak and working twice as hard. And then it might be twice as long because it was substituting for another weak muscle. For instance, the quadriceps might be stabilizing the knee because the calf muscles weren't stabilizing the tibia.
Yeah.
And so you just document this overuse, and I've done it on... I had a formal study of about 50 patients, and now I do it periodically. I've probably got 75 or 100 cases right now recorded. Mm.
But do you just advise them to take it quietly and to alter their lifestyle?
That's right. Lifestyle alteration is the main thing. You just teach them how to... First of all, you have to tell them it's legitimate not to push, because they've been trained that they should work twice as hard to prove they didn't have polio.
Oh, right.
And then I have the therapist work with them closely and show them how to cut their lifestyles down, to get rid of heavy tasks and plan some rest periods, how to do things more easily.
Mm.
And some of them have to quit work. But
what about weight? Being overweight must be a big burden for paralytic patients.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
And patients who are sufficiently motivated and clever enough to lose weight, if they lose 40 pounds, they'll say, I don't need to see you anymore. They'll back to so-called normal. And even 20 pounds makes a big difference. And that's amazing, the number of people have 20 and 40 pounds to lose.
Mm.
Just amazing.
How do you get them to have the old polio patients to keep fit?
Well, they don't... it's not a matter of keeping fit, it's a matter of not overdoing.
Oh, yes.
And so that people always worry about staying fit, but that's really sort of overdone. And a lot of people exercise so they can eat. In fact, I had two sisters that were devastated with their polio, and they were cycling 300 miles a week so they could enjoy all their big meals.
Mm.
And one gal finally, and they had to stop, and then one gal finally got tired of doing that, and she lost 60 pounds, and she's a new woman.
Yeah. Tell me, what about joint replacement with old polio, Jackie? Is it a... Is it on or not?
Well, it's on if they at the hip, because you have to have abductor muscles. If the abductor muscles are less than 3 pus, I don't think you should do it. Mm. And I sort of picked that number because arthritics get along with that. You know, the rheumatoid.
Oh, yes, yes.
And because otherwise you have a dislocating hip, and I've seen one or two of those now. The knee, actually, Marianne Keenan, who's another orthopedic surgeon, she's faculty chairman at Howard Einstein in Philadelphia now, and she's done total knee and a totally flail leg and just put it in a brace, and I put braces on two others, or they've come to me after having total knees. So you have to have
in
some...
A flail knee joint.
Or a weak knee, yeah.
Weak, yeah.
Yeah, so, because... So you have to have muscles support the joint. All the joint replacement does is change the surface. Mm. It doesn't add stability because our hinge joints didn't work. Mm. And not the knee, you can use a brace and have it work. Mm. But the hip, you can't do that. So you have to, so that they have to have enough musculature to stabilize the hip. Mm. Mm.
Tell me, what about the, you mentioned earlier the old, taking down old paralytic fusions that would have been either bent or fused in the wrong place. I see you submitted a thesis to the American Orthopedic Association on this subject, didn't you?
Yes, that was my dissertation for that.
Uh-huh. This was one of your major early contributions, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
What, I mean, in essence, what was the principle of the technique?
Well, the principle of the technique was an osteotomy, resection osteotomy, the apex of the curve, and the key was take out the facet as well as wedge of the body, and the key was to plan the hinge to be at the spinal cord edge of the body so that you didn't kink the cord. So the cord essentially didn't have to change length in any either crunch or stretch, and so you made that the wedge. But you had to take out the facet as well, so you had a total wedge from all the way across.
So, and how did you internally fix them? Or did you?
Well, I didn't.
You cast them externally.
Well, what we did was used a halo cast and wires to to put traction on this and control the spine at that time.
Mm.
Because we did that to get our correction, a slow correction post-op.
Putting on sort of banjo strings onto the
spinous process. Basically, on the lamina.
And then traction on the...
And we had a frame that went on the cast, and then we just turnbuckled the cast, actually, and turned around and got our correction. And once we got our correction, then we did a posterior fusion, and then I'd use Harrington rods, which was the instrumentation at that time.
Were there any problems with the cord?
None. The only one I had a problem with, and I did have one, but a gal had a severe kyphus because she'd had a laminectomy for a tumor years ago, and her spinal cord actually was pale when I opened it up.
Mm.
It was more pale when it shouldn't have
started. It was pale through what?
It had practically no circulation just from deformity, from traction.
Oh.
And that's the only time I had a problem.
And was she walking before?
Yeah, she didn't walk after surgery.
No.
She's my one complication.
Yeah.
And that, it actually was a complication of previous surgery,
sure.
And then I added to it.
Sure. Would you think now that the osteotomies... You could or should consider doing several osteotomies, or would you still consider just doing one apical osteotomy?
Well, if you do just one osteotomy, just do a posterior wedge out of the spine by an old fusion, you get about 10 degrees correction. Now you can do 4 or 5 of them, which John Moe has done. But if you're going to do an apical osteotomy, then you have to have a means of, I think, delayed correction to protect your cord. And if you do that, you can get a much larger correction, and you can get 50, 60-degree correction, which is not possible with instantaneous instrumentation.
Sure. Did you have much experience here in the old days with allograft, bank bone, or you needed it, I suppose, with paralytic patients, didn't you?
Yes, right. Use it freely. And in the original experimentation with bovine bone, the original research bone was good. But when they got to making it commercially, they reduced their techniques, and then it wasn't good. And this has happened more than one time. You know, there's other things that the procedure for mass production misses a step.
Is that right?
Yeah, it wasn't good. But I used a lot of it when it was experimental. and liked it because we were always hungry for bone.
Yeah.
And found bone any place we could get it.
Mm. Tell me about the skull halo, Jackie, because your name is your name and the late Vern Nickel is always linked with the development of the skull halo.
Well, we did it. The history of it is that actually we started out with some patients who had very unstable necks from paralysis and even had trouble speaking and swallowing. And so we tried honed wires, which are really just wire loops through the burr holes in the skull. And that's right. I did two of those so I could position the neck. Well, that was only traction, and we used to have to use pads behind the neck to get the right lordosis, and that wasn't very practical. It was a little hard on the skin, like pressure sores. So then Vernon Nickel went to a meeting, and he learned about this tear, an incomplete loop that they were using for facial maxillary work.
What was this?
Well, it's like an incomplete crown, like a tiara.
Tiara, yes.
And that's what it was. It was two three-quarter circles with pins done by a man named Bloom, who used them for facial maxillary frames so they could pull out the faces.
Mm-hmm.
And Vernon brought that home as the answer. And so
Where did he saw this in a...
At a polio meeting in Houston. So somebody was talking about facial maxillary work. I'm not sure why, but... Anyhow, it was 1956, and he came home with it. And so I stuck it on, and we promptly broke with all the extra holes in it. So then we made a full circle. And then we made an arch in the back so we could get to the upper cervical spine, because I was going up to C2, in fact, the Oxford sometimes, and put it on a frame. And our original frame went way up in the air, about 5 or 6 inches, because these collapsing spines, you'd pull them up that much.
Yeah.
When you straighten them out. Of course, you don't need that with fractures today.
No.
And we put it on body casts. It went clear down to their, usually involved their thighs. And then we initially started it for the neck, and then pretty soon we used it for traction for the entire spine. And that was great. It worked fine. And then that was a framework also for our osteotomies, and it was just a way of holding the whole spine. And then, of course, later it was simplified to, the framework was simplified for fractures.
We got on, and I think you saw the first halo pelvic sets we developed in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I put the first halo on there.
You did, actually, yes.
Yeah, come think of it, that was why I went to Hong Kong.
Was it to get the halo started, was it?
That's right, and then Arthur didn't have a use for it.
Arthur Gow.
So one day, finally, he had a case. I said, well, we had it cooked and sterilized, and it was sitting in the corner. And so one day, he had a case he couldn't stabilize the neck. So very quickly, we suddenly put on a halo, and that started.
Come on.
So it started out as a formal objective, which then became a sort of a casual emergency.
Well, I think before you left, I seem to remember showing you a halo pelvic set. Do you remember with the pelvic head?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Because I seem to remember you leaving in December 68, and I put the first one on in January 69.
Good. Yeah, I think we talked about
it. From then on, we used it hundreds and hundreds of times. I haven't used the halo pelvic thing recently because the shift in disease patterns, but it was number one method of management for the severe deformities.
We tried it here, but it didn't work in our severe polios because there wasn't enough pelvic bone.
Yeah.
We tried it, and we went through the entire pelvis from posterior to anterior.
I know, it was like butter through a knife, knife through butter,
that's
I suppose.
Right.
I think that with the Hong Kong patients, they were certainly lean. They didn't have huge amounts of fatty tissue to rub on the pelvic pins. And I think
no.
That was one bonus.
Well, I'm sure that's a major bonus, because I was very impressed with how lean they were when we were there, and you could actually cut through with the bovi, which, of course, you can't do in a...
Sure.
...our group.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Tell me, a lot of people would say that rehabilitation, certainly in the United States, was pretty much original with you and Vern Nickel at Rancho.
Yes, the history of it is that they had the children's programs, and actually one of the leaders of the children's program was the precursor of Osteostry. That's really where they had a few children's convalescence homes in Europe as well, but mainly there, and then Robert Jones brought surgery into the convalescent home and made it a orthopedic hospital.
You mean historically?
Historically, and then they brought function there, and then they brought more wounded. But as far as rehab for the adults, the only thing
they... Do you mean with Robert Jones?
Yes.
Robert Jones brought surgery into the convalescent home.
Yes, yeah. Agnes Hunt started the convalescent home in England, and the first concept, and I guess there are a couple of small ones, and then he brought surgery into brought medicine into it, and made it a hospital.
Yes.
And so that really started the orthopedic hospital.
That was really sort of Oswestry, I suppose.
That was Oswestry, they call it Bass Church.
Bass Church, yes. Did you ever see Bass Church?
No.
That's a pity, because there's a stone to commemorate the first... it was the first convalescent home, or the first outdoor, the first open air hospital, 1900.
That's right. And
we must show you when you come over next year,
yeah,
Jackie.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. That'd be good. And I'd like to, particularly as I've told you, I'm up on this history because I'm talking about it next month.
Oh, good, on the rehab.
On rehab, history. Then orthopedic rehab, if you get to that. So that was children's rehab, and then they added function. Of course, the idea was to get function while they were convalescing. And then during the two wars, they brought the soldiers in, and you had rehabilitation for the trauma. But it always died down after the war, and so the adults still didn't have any. And then in World War II, they started some spinal injury centers that continued in the Veterans Administration, but they didn't have it for civilians, and they didn't have it for other kind of disability. And we were really probably the ones that pushed it the most, and we're certainly the ones that got orthopedic surgery involved, because they're just things you can't solve with a brace and an anesthetic, historically you can go back to orthopedic rehab is when they did the first tendo-Achilles lengthening of the tenotomies in the 1800s, but we did it a little more precisely. And I just, you know, we did all these spine fusion on these respiratory patients, which theoretically you couldn't do. There are 300 patients that had lengthy spine fusions and that lived on a respirator, or at least for surgery.
Tell me that, did you have much trouble getting them off respirators or the tracheostomies away from them?
If they had breathing capacity, no. Not if they had a breathing capacity to meet it in the first place. So that the only group that we had trouble getting off of respirators and actually didn't would be the muscular dystrophy that had progressive deterioration of the breathing. If their independent breathing capacity was less than 15%, well, then they're going to be permanent tracheostomy patients, and we may have started that during the prior 2 years when we had the surgery and the casting and stuff. Otherwise, the answer is no, you can wean them. And of course, with the CO2 analyzer, the gold foil system, we could follow them very easily and keep track of what's going on.
Tell me, what do you think is your biggest contribution in this whole field, Jackie, looking back?
Well, I considered a lot of the surgery. Vernon and I worked together very closely. It's a little hard to say who did what. And then since then, it's been gait analysis and function.
But, I mean, I seem to remember you doing about 100 different operations on paralytic...
Oh, yeah, we did
that. But you never wrote a lot of it up.
Well, we were too busy.
And we were operating. A lot of it was innovative because you would do what was needed at the time.
Right.
And then...
the splat, actually Al Skerritt really did the final design, but splitting the anterior tip to balance the foot, reconstructive surgery.
This was in stroke patients.
Stroke patients, the flexor hinge hand to stabilize the thumb so you could pinch. Was creative here. Some of the tendon transfers were... We designed a better opponent's plasty that was more reliable. And a lot of little things like that, a lot of them didn't get written up in a better position for shoulder fusion. A good example, I just had a call yesterday about a man has a spinal cord injury patient who's got a totally degenerated shoulder, and he needs...
Is that a Charcot joint? Or?
Well, not really. It doesn't lack a nice sensation. It's just plain mechanical wearing out.
Transferring
a wheelchair.
Oh, yeah, that's... Must be hard.
And so you want to know if you could fuse it. Well, the answer is yes if you don't fuse it too high. Because I have a patient, in fact, I've just seen her recently, who I fused 30 years ago, who's been a wheelchair-dependent patient all along. And you know, if you fuse them down at 30 degrees of abduction rather than 60 degrees of abduction, well, then the arm can come to the side. And I have a patient who's been on crutches, walking with bilaterally fused shoulders, and I just saw him not too long ago.
You wouldn't consider a shoulder joint replacement, would you, for that...
Well,
problem?
No, because it was body weight transfer. I don't think a replacement would take the strain of transfers, both the compression force than the twisting, and neither that man. And I don't. And I think I agree with him. But but shoulder fusion is logical.
I see. But getting the angle right is absolutely critical. Isn't it?
What you have to do is have the arm low enough. The scapula will probably only downwardly rotate about 30 degrees, maybe even 20. And so you have to have it low enough that the scapular rotation will allow the arm to come straight down. And the big error has been putting them out for high reach. And the real reason for a shoulder fusion is to stabilize the arm so the elbow and hand can work. It's not to reach overhead.
What do you think of, in principle, in general terms, of the place of anterior fusion in managing low back pain, obviously when the patient's disabled? Does it make sense to you, or?
Well, it makes sense to me. I mentioned earlier, I've not really treated pain, per se, as a major effort, but it makes good sense to me, because it makes a stable column.
Right.
That's where the weight bearing is, really.
Exactly. And you'll be interested to know that Bob Watkins, one of your ex-fellows, is a great, apart from being a great old fan of yours, is a great disciple, I might say, and is a great, I think he's one of the best men locally here in spinal surgery. But tell me, what about, what are your views on the anterior surgery for, say, scoliosis?
Well, I think anterior fusion, well, if the instrumentation, of course, has changed so that that makes it practical. The other idea I like is you can get to where the deformity is and do wedge resections and
remove the disc.
And get correction, which you can't get from behind.
Do you think there's a tendency nowadays to put in too much metal?
Well, there's an awful lot of it. And I guess the only basis of too much is to question whether they've gotten better corrections and more stability and with fewer complications. And I've not followed that group lately, because when I had to get out of it, I actually had to get out of it entirely when I had my vertebral artery lesion, because I tried to turn...
That's 68.
Yeah. Because 69, yeah. When I turned it over to a younger person, if I were there, I was still the chief.
Yeah.
I couldn't get out of that role. So I had to disappear. And once you... Well, and interesting enough, once you stop doing surgery, you get less interested in the minutiae of the techniques, which are very critical. Nevertheless, you don't do them, and so you don't have this...
But you don't miss doing the surgery at all.
No, I was tired by then. I'd done 300 long, 15-segment extrusions, and enough of that.
It's a massive amount of surgery.
Oh, it's manual labor.
If you had to go through the whole Rancho experience again, would you alter it looking back?
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was very productive.
Would there be any part you would add or concentrate on more? I don't think there is, myself.
No, I really don't. I think we
turned out perfectly, as a...
We had a wide variety of patients, and I think, you know, the one thing we have to worry about today is that the surgeons stay enough involved, they understand the unique complications of a chronically disabled person. It's not just like somebody coming off the ball field with a broken tibia. Look, that person has much better tissues, more turgor, and can get themselves around and can avoid complicating postures, like not having to walk on it, because the only way you can stand up is to step on that leg. You know, I think it's very important that they keep involved. On the other hand, I think it's very important, which I think a major contribution we made was bringing surgery in to reduce the disability by balancing muscle function and getting rid of deformities. Because there's nothing like standing on a straight limb compared to having a brace prop it up.
Sure. Do you think these new patterns of health care are going to be fair on rehabilitation in general?
I think we're going to make a terrible battle for it, and that's why I think a lot of outcome studies are... Well, actually, some of the information is there, but we can't... And one problem is, once you do something right, you don't have a control study to show how it would be wrong if you did it another way, because it's unethical to do it the wrong way.
Yes.
So I think we're going to have, but it has to be a terrible battle, and it's going to have to be maintained.
What, justifying the various surgeries, I suppose?
That's right.
Just demonstrating
that
they are effective.
That's right.
I think this is the problem in the back. I mean, if you compare the natural history of spinal disease, be it back pain or whatever, the real work hasn't been done. We know what happens to the natural history of heart disease, of spinal cord injury, et cetera, but things like back pain and scoliosis, perhaps, but there's an awful lot of spinal problems. We don't know what the natural outcome is without treatment or even with treatment.
I think one of the other problems you have, in addition to that, is that an awful lot of backs, well, you have one and I have one, we still have a maintain a rehab program to keep those backs functioning.
Our own backs.
Our own backs.
Absolutely.
And if you didn't do that, then you'd have a bad result.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it's very necessary that you have a guy. Either you have to be motor oriented, like orthopedic surgeons are, which you and I happen to be, or you have to have a good training program and even periodic check to make sure that the patients protect what they have to keep it going.
Mm.
Because it still takes muscles to protect joints.
Mm.
Joints don't maintain themselves. All you have to do is look at your polios and see how the joints go
sure.
when the muscles go.
Mm. Absolutely. Well, look, our time's nearly up, Jackie. I just want to say thank you very much. It's been marvelous talking to you, and it's great to be back in Los Angeles and to be visiting in Rancho, and thanks very much for your time.
Oh, I think it's been wonderful to have this visit. I appreciate your coming.
Thanks very much, Jackie.